تو خلیج فارس و هرمون، سینه به سینه سلسل کوه البا، وسعت نام تو وسعت نام خورشید، جلوه خاک تو قرمز و سبز و سپید، این نوانم من نوان منم من، ذره خاک وطنم من، ذره خاک وطنم من، ایران خاک در ایران.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you.
And there's an extraordinary amount of mudslinging going on ahead of the Iran's June elections, coming out of the rival camps of the outgoing president and the speaker of Iran's parliament. And this, of course, has forced the supreme leader to publicly rebuke President Ahmadinejad and to scold somewhat more less the speaker, Ali Larijani. Is this unusual? I mean, if not unprecedented?
I mean, it is unusual, particularly given the fact that the mudslinging that we're seeing taking place are happening within the hardline conservative constituency within Iran, who rallied together 4 years ago to crush the democratic aspirations of the Iranian people and the rise of the Green Movement. So what we basically have seen is an internecine sort of factional rivalry being played out in front of the entire nation. And just to give you sort of an example of what happened last week, to draw a parallel, the president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, went before the parliament and in the middle of his public speech sort of played a videotape that allegedly showed the brother of the speaker of the parliament engaging in sort of a backroom deal with several high-ranking members of the Iranian political regime in exchange for political sort of kickbacks, and an attempt to sort of expose and damage the reputation of the Speaker of Parliament. I mean, to draw an analogy with the United States, it would be as if President Obama, in the middle of his State of the Union address, were to, you know, show a videotape that revealed the brother of John Boehner engaged in some sort of backroom sort of economic sort of wheelings and dealings to advance their own private economic interests. So this has sort of greatly damaged the, you know, image and the reputation of all politicians who are active in Iran right now. And the supreme leader, whose job is to preserve stability and order, has publicly rebuked both parties for damaging the reputation and the integrity of Iran's political system. And, of course, this is all happening because there is supposed to be another presidential election in June, and all sort of political constituencies, the two main camps that are active publicly in Iran, the camp of Ahmadinejad and the camp of the supreme leader, for which the Speaker of Parliament is allied with the supreme leader, basically two camps, are really publicly sort of fighting over the future of the Islamic Republic.
So where does the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards Corps, who's supposed to be the power behind the throne, where are they in this battle between Ahmadinejad and the Speaker Larijani?
Yep.
Because I know that Ahmadinejad has got connections to the IRGC, but also the Supreme Leader's son, Motion, also does. So I'm a little confused.
Yeah, I mean, the senior commanders of the Islamic Republican Guard Corps, the Revolutionary Guards, in other words, they are all handpicked and selected and rotated regularly by the office of the Supreme Leader. So they are all, at least the senior leadership, the senior officer corps, they are all deeply loyal to the office of the Supreme Leader and increasingly critical of Ahmadinejad, who really now is acting as sort of a rogue element here. I mean, it's important for your listeners to realize that just because Ahmadinejad is the president of Iran, he doesn't have the same political powers as the president of the United States does. The power in Iran is fundamentally sort of enshrined, and it's located in the office of the Supreme Leader, who really has complete sort of power, if he chooses to wield it, to intervene in any aspect of politics in the interests of preserving the Islamic Republic of Iran. So Ahmadinejad is a very weak sort of player, but because he does have an office of the presidency, he does have access to the state media, he does have a lot of resources at his disposal, which can sort of make life very complicated, and he can embarrass those of his rivals, and that's what he's seeking to do in the last few months of his political office.
But it also seems, Nader Hashemi, that he's also embarrassing the Supreme Leader, and maybe that's what he's trying to do here, because the Supreme Leader is apparently guilty of a lot of poor judgment. And is this what's going on, that this is Ahmadinejad's strategy?
I think so, yeah. I think what's happening is that Ahmadinejad and his supporters have been suffering from delusions of grandeur, that they, you know, really do have power within Iran's political system and also on the global stage, and they're trying to continue that legacy. Now that Ahmadinejad's two-term presidency is coming to the end, they have aspirations to present a candidate in the next presidential election who will continue the Ahmadinejad sort of line of thinking, ideologically, politically. But there's a counter-movement that has emerged that is trying to rein him in because he's viewed to be too independent. And so what Ahmadinejad has been seeking to do in terms of using leverage that he has to try and advance the cause of his own political campaign is to really send a subtle message to the Supreme Leader and to the camp of the Supreme Leader that, look, I have a lot of state secrets that I can reveal to the public that would be deeply embarrassing to the integrity of the Islamic Republic. So don't push me too far, or I will start revealing these secrets, as he did last week. In other words, secrets that deal with the high level of corruption, the nepotism, the cronyism, which exists in all authoritarian states, including Iran, where there's a lot of money because of the sale of oil. And so that's the game that he's playing right now. He's saying that, look, you know, if you try and sort of restrict my movement, if you prevent me from running a candidate in the next presidential election, I have a number of cards that I'm going to play that will embarrass you. So just be careful. So that's, I think, what's really going on here between the camp of Ahmadinejad and the camp of the Supreme Leader.
And again, I'm speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. And we're talking about the mudslinging that's going on ahead of the elections in June in Iran between the Speaker of the Parliament, who is close to the Supreme Leader, and the outgoing President, Ahmadinejad. And of course, he doesn't have a lot of ability to the clerics choose the next leaders. But is this all? This seems to be all happening in a broader geostrategic problem that Iran is having. You know, they're faced with a major setback in Syria, which could also translate into a breakup of Iraq, which is their major prize. I mean, thanks to the stupidity of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, Iraq was sort of handed to Iran. But I think if Syria falls, that could have a ripple effect. The Sunni in Iraq are already very restive, and the Kurds in the north haven't been getting any oil revenue. So that place is a real tinderbox. So is this to say that the IRGC, the Kurds, the leadership, are all somewhat in disarray?
Well, I think they're facing a number of sort of different pressures. I think what we just talked about are sort of the internal domestic pressures and struggles over the future of the Islamic Republic, different sort of constituencies, which really, if you boil it down, they're different sort of rival mafia sort of groups that have an extensive sort of patronage clientele network that they're trying to preserve for their own supporters. So there's that internal battle that's going on between, you know, different factions within the Islamic Republic of Iran. But at the same time, as you said, all this is happening in the context of a broader geostrategic sort of set of developments in the Middle East that does not look very good for Iran's national interests. particularly the case of Syria. If Assad falls, that would result in a huge setback for Iran's regional influence. Just the other day, a senior clerical figure in Iran gave a speech where he basically said that Syria is Iran's 35th province, that we will not let it go, that it's so vital to Iran's national interest that they will use everything at their disposal to preserve the Assad regime. Just today, there's reports of Hezbollah forces supported by Iran entering into the war in Syria on behalf of the Assad regime. So Iran is very worried about what's happening to its regional influence. And on top of that, you know, the Arab Spring developments have been, if one is honest about it, have been basically a setback for Iran, because you have other nationalist forces that are coming to power who are really saying that, look, the Islamic Republic of Iran is not our model for political development, for a political system. We really look to Turkey and that form of that model of mixing religion and politics is much more of a model that political Islamist forces in Egypt and Tunisia seek to aspire to, and that Iran is not some country that emerging religious-based parties want to emulate. So Iran knows that, and it's very worried about its declining influence. And of course, at an international level, there's the ongoing sort of crisis and conflict with the United States, the possibility of a war breaking out, the possibility of an attack on Iran's military nuclear sites, and also, and most importantly, the increasing sanctions that are really taking a heavy toll on Iran's economy and on the quality of life and the standard of living of most average Iranians. So these things are happening all at the same time.
Well, my understanding, Nada Hashimi, is that when you mentioned that Ahmadinejad, who is quite reviled in the West, and it's hard to get your head around the idea that in this struggle he may actually be more progressive than the supreme leader, or less conservative. You know, it's hard to know. And I welcome your comments on that. But
yeah, no, I wouldn't sort of view this as sort of a choice between a good side and a bad side. Basically, these are two factions who basically have their own extensive sort of patron clientele networks that are deeply implicated in all of the human rights abuses in the Islamic Republic of Iran, fighting for political power. In one sense, I guess if one wanted to spin it, Ahmadinejad does have a particular anti-clerical bent toward his political orientation, but not because he's in favor of, you know, freedom of religion, or he is against sort of clerical hegemony. He was very comfortable working with clerical figures in Iran when he was advancing his own personal and political career. So there is a tension between the camp of the supreme leader, which is much more dominated by clerical figures, and those of Ahmadinejad, who tend to comprise mostly laymen. But none of them are standing for any sort of progressive political principles that come anywhere close to what you and I would consider to be democratic or respectful of universal human rights standards. So I think that has to be clear. This is sort of an internecine sort of hardline conservative struggle for political power inside the Islamic Republic between two nefarious sides, and it's really debatable which side is worse.
And my understanding is that amongst the educated and urban Iranians, they basically despise the clerics. So that's the whole seething part of Iran's polity that we don't hear much about since the Green Movement.
Well, that's true. I mean, because, you know, Iran has had a very bitter experience over the last 33 years. Religion has been in political power. Clerics have been in political power. A new generation has emerged after the revolution that has no memory of life before the revolution. And so, you know, the demographic figures are about 2/3 of Iranians are under the age of 30. They have known nothing but clerical political rule. And so Iran had and it still has a sizable middle class. And so there are aspirations for freedom and for self-determination that are being blocked by the current regime in power, which is dominated by clerics. And so that leads to a particular anti-clericalism. That's simply, I think, a natural reaction to the state of politics in Iran, and it's very deeply felt and widespread. But it's also important to point out that this regime in Iran is also very critical and goes to extreme lengths to prevent alternative interpretations of Islam from emerging. There are a number of senior clerics who have much more democratically friendly interpretations, more human rights friendly interpretations of Islam, that the regime does not allow their voice to be heard on state television or radio. They're silenced, they're put under house arrest. And so the regime is very fearful of alternative interpretations of religion emerging because it bases its legitimacy on the claim that it embodies Islamic authenticity and there is only one interpretation of Islam. And if you oppose the Islamic Republic of Iran, then you cannot be a good, pious and practicing Muslim. And so it uses the theme of religion, it cynically manipulates it to preserve its own stranglehold on society, particularly among the poor and more religiously devout segments of society. So it plays a very cynical game. And it's fundamentally, I think, what we're seeing in Iran right now, if one sort of looks at sort of the evolution of the Islamic Republic over the last 33 years, particularly over the last 4 years since the events of 2009, the regime is suffering a huge crisis of legitimacy. It knows this, and it goes to extreme lengths to censor, to prevent the dissemination of free ideas, to block satellite television, to prevent, for example, the BBC Persian service from being broadcast into Iran, simply because the BBC broadcast service is doing sort of a really good job in reporting the news, and the regime can't tolerate an honest assessment and interpretation of the news. And so I think these are all signs of a regime that are sort of struggling to preserve itself. And ironically, what's really keeping this regime alive is the threat of an external military strike from the United States, which the Islamic Republic uses routinely to justify its own existence, to rally people around the flag, to claim that it is the embodiment of preserving Iran's national independence and integrity against predatory foreign powers that are trying to subvert and subject and humiliate Iran. And so, ironically, I would argue that U.S. foreign policy, actually, both the past and in the present, is actually playing into the hands of the clerical regime and actually strengthening it in ways that are, I think, very destructive for pro-democracy forces within the country.
Well, my understanding, when you mentioned earlier, Nada Hashemi, that Ahmadinejad is conducting a kind of veiled blackmail against the supreme leader in this spat that they're having, that he's got a lot of secrets that could embarrass the regime. My understanding is, for example, that when Ahmadinejad last came to the United Nations, his private cinematographer, he traveled with him everywhere, defected to the West with enormous, defected to the United States, presumably to the CIA, with enormous amounts of cards, memory cards from cameras, etc. Of high-level inspection trips to the underground nuclear facilities, accompanied by the Supreme Leader, etc., capturing all their conversation, this kind of stuff. So do you know anything about the extent to which that sounds like it's more of an embarrassment to Ahmadinejad, but do you know anything more about these reports?
No, I don't. But you are right. There was a report that a photographer, or I think he was a videographer, who was with Ahmadinejad and his entourage when he came to the United States last time in September, did defect. I have not heard of reports that you've just mentioned of him bringing with him all of these video images and videotapes of visits to nuclear sites that could prove embarrassing. I suspect he probably did have those with him. If he was the official sort of photographer or videographer of the president of Iran, I'm sure he had access to those images. And if he did, he probably turned them over to the United States, which they're probably viewing or have viewed already. But you hearing it from you is the first time I've actually heard those reports, but they seem perfectly realistic given the fact that there was this high-level defection, and what exactly was brought with this defector is unknown to me. But I mean, I think that's what you've just stated is perfectly within the realm of the possible.
Well, just in closing, Nada Hashemi, given that the clerics just vet the candidates they're not likely to have anybody that's not a hardliner. What do you expect? Just more of this? I guess what we talked about earlier is that the bigger picture, if Syria falls, etc., are going to have more impact. But just in terms of the June elections. What do you expect?
Well, I'm expecting that they're going to try and make sure that what happened 4 years ago does not repeat itself. In other words, the number of candidates who are allowed to run for office are going to be carefully selected so that all of them are strong loyalists of the supreme leader. But here's the catch. The Islamic Republic of Iran is in a dilemma here because it tries to use presidential elections to generate a huge public turnout to send a message to the West that Iran does have strong popular support. Now, this time around, it's going to be much more difficult for them to do so. One, because of the Arab Spring, the global spotlight now is on authoritarian regimes and supportive of popular sort of pro-democracy movements in the region. So the regime is much more sensitive to ensuring a high voter turnout as a way of sending a message to the Western world that we are not like Mubarak, we're not like other authoritarian regimes, we're not like Assad, we do have popular support. But the regime can't generate popular support to come out to the voting polls unless it actually broadens the political sphere and allows for a range of candidates to run for political office that actually give voters a choice. And then the dilemma here is that's what the regime tried 4 years ago. It did allow for Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi, two prominent reformist candidates, to run, thinking that they would be loyal sort of stooges of the supreme leader. But when the election results were announced and they were widely perceived to be fraudulent, these opposition leaders, reformist leaders, spoke out against the election, defied the supreme leader, and Iran descended into its biggest sort of post-revolutionary crisis in 33 years. So this is the dilemma facing the regime coming in the coming sort of months as we head to the June election. How do you ensure a huge popular turnout as a way of shoring up its own credibility and sending a message to the West? But how do you do it? How do you do it in a way that you don't allow for a repetition of what happened 4 years ago? So this is the big sort of crisis that the regime is facing. Just today, it was announced that the supreme leader was meeting with senior reformist figures at his office, I suspect trying to coerce or coax them into running for political office. But, of course, the consensus among the reformist movement, the Green Movement in Iran, is that there's going to be no participation in fraudulent elections while there is no freedom for political parties, while the leaders of the Green Movement are in jail, while there's no freedom of the press. So, I mean, this is the big sort of dilemma that the Islamic Republic is facing as we head toward the June election.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nada Hashimi.
Happy to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nada Hashimi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He is the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the latest UN report on the worsening civil war in Syria that's cost 70,000 lives so far and is becoming increasingly sectarian.
ای فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو